All right, good morning, everyone. It is Tuesday, September 22nd, 2020, 9:04 a.m. I'm Commissioner Brian Crotchis, joined by Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk and Commissioner Randy Christman. This is a MISO update, a biannual update, with representatives from MISO as well as the Commission, of course. Welcome, everyone, from afar. I see we've got a number of people on this particular call this morning, so obviously doing it remotely because of COVID-related concerns, but nonetheless, I think it'll be effective. And again, it's just good to have everyone on. Commissioner Christman, do you have any opening comments?
No, only to welcome everybody and looking forward to the information.
Thank you. And I'm going to turn it over to our MISO representative, Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk, and she can from here.
Thank you, gentlemen. Good morning, Julie Fedorchuk, with the North Dakota Public Service Commission. These meetings are always a really good opportunity to have just a good candid discussion with all of the representatives from our RTOs. You guys play a huge role in ensuring and delivering reliability in a way to our electric customers that is in tandem with us, and it's a partnership, but it's no doubt a really important one, and your actions have a huge effect on our ratepayers. So these are important conversations. There's so much going on with the transformation of the grid. I have found myself working more and more in this area, and look forward to the discussion today and all the important topics we've laid out. I do want to mention that John Wieda is the head of the North Dakota Transmission Authority, and he is on the phone. I'm not sure if he is able to communicate, but in a second I'll ask him to say hello. We've asked John to listen in, and he also may have some questions to contribute to the discussion as well. Just thought it would be helpful. He brings things from a different perspective slightly, but is an important player in this arena for the state, and it seems like he should be involved in these discussions too, both MISO, and I think he's planning to be at the Capitol for SPP. So with that, John, are you on the phone and able to speak? Not sure if he has a line that is communicative. Steve,
I'm not seeing
it. It doesn't sound like it. John, we're going to email you the information for the WebEx, and maybe you can log on that way. And so, yeah, he says he doesn't have an option to unmute. He can't talk. We'll get you hooked in the other way, John. Look for an email from Victor Shook. Alrighty, with that, we'll go ahead and get started. I think we have a lineup here ready to go for MISO. So whoever is participating for MISO, if you can take the lead now and introduce your team and get started. Thank you.
Good morning, commissioners. This is Allison Archer with MISO. Just thanks for having us today. It's a different type of meeting than what we're used to. We're used to coming up to North Dakota and being able to be in the same room and have these conversations. We have several topics. Let me see if I can get the. There we go. So we have several topics today. I'm just going to introduce the order of operations and then the individuals that will be presenting on each of the topics, and then I'll pass it off to them. We're going to start with the interconnection queue update. Andy Whitmire, I don't believe, has ever been in front of the North Dakota Commission before. He will be presenting on this topic. He's the Director of Resource Utilization. Then the UNTEP Futures and Siting of Generation, Tony Hunsinger, has definitely been up to North Dakota before. He's the Manager of Policy and Regulatory Planning, and all things futures is what I tend to say about Tony. We'll move on to long-range transmission planning with Audrey Johnson, our Executive Director of System Planning and Competitive Transmission, and then move on to the forward market needs with the Director of Market Design, Kevin Benoit, and follow up with the cost allocation updates also by Audrey Johnson. Along the way, obviously, if there's any questions, please interject if there's anything else that you want to talk about. We're happy to do that. Also on the line is Brian Pillow, our Executive Director of External Affairs for the North, and Derek Mossoff and Darren Lahr are our regional directors up here in the North that work with the customers. So I will pass that off to Andy at this point.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Andy Whitmire, Director of Regionalization. Recently moved into planning at MISO after spending 16 years in micro operations. My group, as we go to the next slide, does resource planning as part of MISO's value-based planning approach. We do evaluations of all new generation interconnect requests. We identify what upgrades necessary and then eventually integrate those resources. We also manage the reliability planning for any retirement requests or any potential replacement requests that may come in for retiring resources. Go to the next slide. Get a look of what is in the interconnection request just in North Dakota. We currently have 4.2 gigawatts of projects in North Dakota. They are all wind and solar projects. The 4.2 gigawatts of our active queue, so those are resources that have either entered in April of 2017 all the way until earlier this year when we had our 2020 application window closed in June of 2020. We've had 7.5 gigawatts total out of the MISO queue since February 2016. Of those, 2 gigawatts have gone through the full cycle, so those are the ones that were from the February 16 all the way through February 17 group. The majority of those, 1.6 gigawatts, withdrew due to high commission costs, but we were able to integrate about 400 megawatts through interconnection agreements. The remaining 1.3 withdrew in through different phases of the active queues, again, due to high commission costs. One note is that all 2 gigawatts from the February 17 group, or all 1.6 gigawatts from February 16 withdrew, and none of those were able to get through. This changing portfolio to solar is consistent through the rest of the MISO footprint, as we'll see in later slides. And as well as we go to slide 6, you'll see that this change is happening through the rest of our neighbors as well. It's hard to see in this map, but there's a lot of diamonds and star representing wind and solar, and not a lot of other resources. So this changing resource mix to renewables is seen throughout our footprint and our neighbors. We'll need to address these changes to coordinate with our region, with our neighbors, as we manage this changing portfolio.
Andy.
Yes.
This is Commissioner Fedorchak. On that slide, what are the gas? What shape is the gas?
A gas is circles or ovals.
Okay. How many megawatts of gas are in that queue?
I'm sorry?
How many megawatts of gas are you showing up there? Can you...
In our queue, in the next slide, we can show that what's in our queue. I don't have the numbers offhand as what's in everyone else's queue. For us, of the gas is the blue. So we're representing 8... Sorry, pull that up here. So in the bottom right-hand corner, it's about 6 gigawatts of gas, or about 17 projects for our entire footprint. And the majority of that is in our south footprint.
Okay. Compared to what's the total for the others in the queue?
We have currently 108 gigawatts in our queue. So that's about...
Okay.
Do a quick math here.
1.5%.
Yeah.
Thanks, Aubrey.
So very small percentage. So if you look at this slide here, so when we had our 2020 cycle kickoff in June, we ended up having 52 gigawatts come into our queue, representing 353 projects. That is the largest we've ever had in our footprint in our history. And it, at the time, it got our queue all the way up to 113 gigawatts. It's dropped now down to 108 due to withdrawals. But of those 52 gigawatts, 69% were solar, and that's represented by the yellow. And the green is wind. So the majority of the resources throughout all of our study areas, as you can see on the left, are solar projects or wind projects.
Andy, this is Randy Christman, and I don't know if it's on here. If it is, I haven't figured it out yet, but you said that the 6 megawatts of gas that are in the queue are mostly in the south. Is there any of that in your north region or north district or whatever the term is in MISO?
Yeah, let me get you that number here real quick. There is a small amount. I don't have it readily offhand here. I have to go in and get the numbers from my team, but I can certainly get you that number and follow up with you.
Okay, thank you.
One more quick question, and this is going in a little bit of a different direction than the queue, but just curious, in that same vein of these new ones, the new resource coming in, how many gigawatts of retired resources do you have? I'm assuming mostly coal, but is that just a number that you have on the tip of your tongue?
I don't have that number. We have seen the majority of our retirements be of coal. I don't have that number offhand. We do also, we can only provide what has been officially retired. Anything that is may be within a attachment Y, we have to keep that confidential. So even though a customer may publicly say that they're retiring a resource, if anything is within attachment Y, they've submitted to MISO for us to study that retirement, we keep that confidentiality. So we're only able to share what has officially been retired and is now offline. I don't have that number.
So only when it's offline, nothing that's been announced to retire. It's only the offline stuff once it's no longer producing.
Open approved. If we've approved it,
I see.
And they accepted the attachment final improvement, then it may still be online. But if it's an approved retirement, then they acknowledge they're giving up those interconnection rights once the unit comes offline.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Excuse me, Commissioner. So one of the things I believe, this is Aubrey Johnson again, I believe in my presentation at System Planning Committee in June, if not in September, we did have some retirement analysis done and the amount of retirement. We had a graph in there for the retirement. So we can work with Allison and pull that information from that presentation and share with you what we know of that's already slotted for retirement as far as gigawatts. For this year and for the past years.
Okay, thank you, Aubrey.
So as we continue on to the next slide, we've done a lot of improvements over the last year and through this year. On ways to improve the interconnection process. Most notably, earlier this year, we launched 2 new applications, a new automated queue application process, which allows interconnection customers to submit all their paperwork electronically to us. And we've also created a point of interconnection map, which gives a way for folks to go out and look at the grid and find spots where it may be most advantageous to connect, looking at the current model and where there may be megawatts available to interconnect in certain parts of our footprint. We also we're continuing to process here in 2020 reforms to our interconnection process through FERC Order 845. We're looking at traditional owners self-funding election, several changes to our pro forma agreements, and continuing to implement the effective systems order, which was been in front of for the last couple of years. Later on this year, we're continuing to work on cost certainty and reduce the timelines for the queue. We'd like to have the queue down to a year. Currently, the process is 505 days from a submittal to all the way through GIA completion. So it's about 2 years, a little less than 2 years. We'd like to get it down to a year to have it better fully integrate into the rest of the NTAP processes. Now, obviously, we have 13 ongoing cycles right now, dating all the way back to February 2017 cycle. We're waiting on vaccination results on those. We can process those and continue to work through the queue. So our goal over the next year or two is to work through that backlog with our neighbors on completing those backlogs and getting those resources either online or out of the queue to increase costs. As we look on to the future, the next slide, earlier this year, MISO published a Generation Q Outlook report. And we, as we talked about earlier, with 52 gigawatts coming into our queue in June, that far exceeded what we expected. But we do continue to expect to see over 20 gigawatts of resources come into the queue each year. Most of it we expect to be solar and wind. We do start seeing gas in later years. That's our projection. So we're ranging anywhere from the gray bar shows your certainty level from, you know, the lowest to highest. We continue to hopefully, you know, our expectation is by 2023, 2024, that we get through the backlog and we are processing each of these requests as they come in each year. So as these 20 or so gigawatts of projects come in, we're able to process them, determine which ones can come online, identify necessary upgrades, roll them into our overall MTEP plan, and then start again. But the message here is that we're continuing to see this large expansion in renewables, which kind of feeds into our future developments.
Is the
which we'll talk about soon.
Just a quick question: is the ramp up in gas generation? Is that reactive in nature in terms of to address the number of renewables coming online, or is that based on known plant closures on the coal side?
Could you say that again, please?
Okay, the gas starts to ramp up 2023, 2024, and it peaks, so to speak, in 2026 through 2029. Are the projections on the increase in gas based on just reacting to the additional intermittent resources coming online, or is that projection based on known coal plant closures?
So we get our, the way we work with our OMS survey that we issue every year to get an understanding of what resources may be retiring. We take that information as well as trends from previous years, our work through RAND and knowing what type of resource mix we'll need as far as capacity credits, and those go into that forecast. I think Tony will talk a little bit more about how we develop these, our futures, and the future one, and is what was a big part in coming up with this projection for the queue additions over the next few years.
Andy, I might just pause here for a second to take care of a little housekeeping item. I've had a number of people texting me wanting to see the slides. Because on the phone bridge, all they can do is hear. And so how do you guys feel about broadcasting this so people can see the slides? Or alternatively, I guess we could take a minute, get the slides posted on the on our website, and they can try to follow along that way.
Yeah, they could probably hop on to the Steve, what's the easiest at this point? Since
they could go on to the meeting if we sent that information to them, or I can turn on the public broadcast. Those are those two areas. The other one is to post the slides to the website.
So you can turn the public broadcast on immediately?
Yes.
I'm fine with that.
And then they can see everything. I don't know how do you guys feel?
I'm fine.
I've had a request from Jean Schaefer, and she's had four people texting her asking for the slides. So it's obviously
At this stage,
a subject of interest
at this
to
stage, the only people,
stakeholders.
Right, who are going to know that the slides are available would be the ones who are on. I don't think it's going to in either way, I'm fine with it either way. I think it's good. Commissioner Christman, do you have a preference either way?
Steve, I think you're okay. Randy said he's okay with posting or broadcasting. Okay. So now anybody listening should be able to go to our live broadcast and see the whole presentation as well. Okay, that's easier than trying to get the slides posted.
Sorry, and Steve, the place to go for the live broadcast, just go to our on the front page of the PSC website, ndpsc.com.
Okay.
Andy, is that it?
Yeah, it is. And Andy, just make sure you're doing whatever you can on your end to have the highest quality sound. I don't know if there's anything you can do. It's apparently on the broadcast it sounds a little garbled. Okay. Thank you.
Andy and
okay, this is Andy's last slide. And we're happy to take questions if you have additional questions. This is Aubrey Johnson again.
Okay.
I just wanted to take a moment to just make one point relative to our interconnection queue that I don't believe we stated earlier. So at any point in time, one of the things we always like to mention is that historically, our interconnection queue sees about 20% of the projects that enter any particular cycle actually move forward to a generated interconnection agreement, which is really more of an indication that the project will actually become, go forward to construction. So if you think about our latest queue being 52 gigawatts, we should expect that on the back end of that process, we would see approximately 10 gigawatts actually move forward to a full generated interconnection agreement. So as Andy mentioned earlier, what we think about is the robustness of the interconnection queue is really an indicator of what trends we will see and gives us an indication of what that resource mix will be in the future going forward.
Yeah, thanks, Aubrey. Is my sound better?
Yes.
Sounds better.
Good. To add on to that, we've completed about 200 generation interconnection agreements totaling 36 gigawatts of new resources from 2015 to 2019, which is consistent with that about 20% of the projects actually getting through to the grid.
Andy?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
When earlier on you mentioned a big surge this year, and I think you even specified June in particular, can you refresh me on what that point was you were making?
Sure. Alfie, you mind going back two slides, please? So we have a submission deadline for 2020 was June 25th of 2020 was the submission. So any project that wanted to get into the MISO queue for the 2020 year had to have all of their documents submitted by June 25th. We were projecting around 30 gigawatts to come in based on what we had published in our queue outlook report. We ended up having 52 gigawatts actually come into the queue on that date.
Yeah, how?
The smaller on the right is the submissions that came in 2020.
You had how many come in?
52 gigawatts, totaling for 353 projects, and 69% of that was solar projects.
And what was your expectation?
We had a range of anywhere between 9 and 40 from our report, averaging about 30. So we came in 20 gigs over that estimate. And that estimate was just based off of, you know, previous queue entries and trying to create a trend as to what we might see based on previous years. But this year far surpassed previous submissions.
So that tells me, if you move forward two slides, would I be correct in saying that this forecast is pretty loose and shouldn't be counted on as being particularly accurate based on the accuracy of your forecast for this year?
It certainly would impact, if we were to recreate these numbers, yes, we would probably see a change in these numbers. What we have seen from our futures development, I think the generation mix is correct. But the amount of gigawatts certainly could vary.
Okay, thanks.
What do you use the forecasted queue volume for? What do you use that chart for?
It was probably our first time creating this chart as part of our queue outlook report. It's just more to inform interconnection customers and MISO stakeholders as how we see the queue changing over the next few years as we continue to see a change in renewable resources and eventually gas to replace a lot of the aging infrastructure.
Okay, thank you. All right.
It was our attempt to say how the futures are changing, and Tony will talk about the futures here in a second, but how those future changes will impact what we see come through the queue.
Thank you, Andy. Looks like that's it for questions on our end, unless, John, Rita, you have any. All right. Well, I think Tony's next.
All right. Well, good morning. And can I just do a quick sound check, see if I'm coming across all right?
Sounds good to me. Others are nodding. Are you speaking on a phone or a speakerphone, or how are you speaking?
Speaking through a laptop or a tablet. Can I switch to a phone if necessary?
I think it's okay, you guys?
I'm going to start for a while.
Yeah, sounds all right. Thanks, Tony.
Okay. So I'm heading second in the lineup today, and my topic is largely focused on the MISO futures. The MISO futures have been developed as part of our regional planning. So that the graphic that you have up on the screen right now, as we look at the realm of MISO's planning efforts belongs into the regional planning bucket. And this is the category of planning that is charged with delivering the MISO transmission expansion plan, the annual plan that actually takes 18 months to develop, but merges the reliability aspects with the economic policy aspects and looking out 20 years into the future. We can move on to the next slide. The futures themselves. So we use the MISO futures to help us plan in a 20, 30, 40 year out time period. As we're looking out that far into the future, it becomes really hard to predict what the future would be. So one of the tools that we use to help mitigate that risk in picking what the future will be is developing a suite of futures or differing planning scenarios in which we will build models for, and as we're studying potential transmission projects, we then use the futures to test the viability and the benefits of those potential projects. And so the futures are snapshots of what could be out into the future. And some of the key factors that go into it are, you know, what are our load assumptions? What's going to be, you know, the demand and the energy, you know, each year or 20 years out? What are the prices around constructing and operating and maintaining various different generator resources? What are your assumptions around fuel prices that go into those resources? You know, from a policy perspective, what is going to be out there? You know, in the past we've had renewable portfolio standards. In the kind of more recent history, we've had some analysis and discussions around emissions. And, you know, certainly, you know, today the policies, at least kind of from a federal level, it's been kind of missing. So you're seeing a lot of states and a lot of utilities putting forth their own goals around various different aspects of these plans. And so really the futures is trying to pull those various different aspects into these different scenarios and creating a suite that can book in what the future will look like. We can move to the next slide. So beginning in 2019, last year, we started a initiative in trying to redevelop our futures. So in the past, we've had four sets of futures that the upper bookend of those futures was starting to basically be a minimum representation of what our membership was doing. So taking a look at the goals and public announcements that a lot of our member utilities have been committing to, whether it's the public announcements or their publicly traded documents, as well as what the states were looking at, we quickly realized that our accelerated fleet change feature was beginning to not book in that upper bound. And so in 2019, we kicked off an initiative with the MISO stakeholders in retooling and redeveloping what the futures could be. And so that effort is coming to a conclusion this year. As we worked with stakeholders in developing what the futures could be, we basically settled on three futures that we would use to bookend the regional planning analysis back in the April-May timeframe. And right now, we're in the midst of performing the generation resource expansion analysis and deciding to put what kind of future generation is needed in the models so we can perform the reliability and economic studies. And so the three futures, we did away with the naming convention on them and just called them Futures 1, 2, and 3. And Future 1 represents what's in line with our current membership's announced plans. And so this is taking a survey out there of what's been publicly announced. The organization of MISO States has also helped us in facilitating a survey and collecting some of those announcements and plans. And so Future 1 is representing 85% of the utility and state goals as far as renewable energy and decarbonization. As we were collecting that information, we also collected public announcements and, you know, filed RFPs that indicated various different unit retirements and additions. And so we've also, we had the model reflect that as well. Future 2 builds upon Future 1. So everything that was done in Future 1 is you know, from a announcement RFP perspective is built into Future 2. The difference being that in Futures 2 and 3, we now have 100% of the announced plans and RFPs built into them. And then Future 2 brings in a MISO footprint wide 60% carbon emission reduction goal by 2040. And it also brings in an energy increase of 30%. And this is largely driven by electrification. And in this sense, electrification is more than just electrification of the auto industry. So in past MTEP cycles, we've had assumptions around electric vehicles and electric vehicle penetration. You know, in this sense, electrification still includes electric vehicles, but it also captures the transition away from other fuel sources in like residential or light commercial or industrial processes. So this could capture stuff such as your electric water heating, you know, converting over to away from natural gas to, you know, other electric sources and whatnot. Future 3 is meant to be the furthest out bookend, and so this is introducing a 80% carbon emissions reduction goal across the footprint. And again, this is at the end or by 2040, so the end of 2039. It also increases the energy demand to 50%, again, largely driven by electrification.
Can I interrupt you for a question here?
Go ahead.
Something that, looking at the charts, I'm failing to understand. From Future 1 to Future 2, I understood you to say that a lot of the change was more electrification, replacing the gas things that you mentioned. And yet, from Future 1 to 2, it seems to show, well, more solar, but less wind and more gas usage. So that would seem to conflict with that there's a big change in electrification going on there.
Yeah, so the electrification change is captured in the basically the load aspect, and I don't have a good graphic to show the differences in the demand and energy load and the actual load shape. I can get that to you. That was probably something we should have provided in here. So these charts are looking at the resource mix from a resource perspective. And so you know, the difference between Future 1 and Future 2 is going to be driven by largely by your assumption on the announced plans. You know, in Future 1, you have 85%. Future 2, you're going to be at 100%. There's also some assumptions around retirements. So the retirement assumptions can change between Futures 1, 2, and 3, which will affect the you know, the makeup of the you know, for these resource pie charts.
Okay, thanks, Tony.
So Tony, this is Aubrey Johnson again. Let me just jump in. Commissioner, that's a great observation. A couple of things to add to Tony's comments. So one is we're looking at this analysis. We're thinking about both the demand, which is where he speaks towards electrification, but you also are talking about the energy, which is the resources that actually work to meet that demand. When you start thinking about more electrification, you also have to think about more of when things might happen on peak, when charging occurs, what happens in different types of scenarios. So in that particular case, you may need different types of resources to meet those particular demands. So it may change what that resource mix is depending upon what those demand changes are as part of that model. And that may change, that changes the shapes that you're seeing relative to the amount of gas pickup and the changes with solar. So that's just a little bit of some of the sausage that gets made as to how the futures are set up.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wasn't thinking of that. Thank you.
One other follow-up question, and that is Do the futures take into account any carbon capture and sequestration for coal or gas? Like that technology coming to fruition, and how is that considered in these futures?
Yeah, so we do have a resource option for the integrated gasification, the IGC, which would be the coal, kind of the new advanced lower emission coal. And we also have the combined cycle with carbon capture, and I can never pronounce this word, but sequestration. but that's the capturing the carbon emissions. Yeah. So those are both planning alternatives or resource alternatives that are available for the economic tool to pick as it's trying to minimize the resource expansion costs for the entire MISO footprint. As we are performing the resource expansion analysis, the combined cycle carbon capture and sequestration is actually being picked definitely in Future 3. And I believe there was maybe one picked in Future 2 as well.
Okay, thank you.
But again, the tool that we're using in helping us forecast what the resource expansion is, at its heart, is trying to minimize not only the investment steel on the ground, but also the operating costs. Given a constraint of a certain planning reserve margin, the constraints of any kind of carbon emission goals or any kind of RPS, renewable portfolio standard goals.
So just in a kind of a brief way, if you can discuss how these futures are applied down the road to justify or find or not find projects, new transmission projects, economic.
Yeah, so the futures, right now we're in a step where the futures are affecting what the new resource build out will be added into the models to help address any of the retirements and the load growth that is going in, make sure that we keep the planning reserve margins. Once that is done and we cite that in the model, which gives those resources a specific location, from there, then it goes over to the economic analysis where they're looking at ways to make the MISO footprint more economical. So this is largely focused at relieving congestion. And so the type of resources that the futures are picking can influence what kind of projects could or would be approved, largely based on where the location of those future projected resources would be. Hope I didn't lose you kind of through that maze, but it's really the location of the resources that's really going to kind of drive the benefits around the economic analysis.
Okay. And are the futures all, like there's three futures, so how do you decide which one to use in any given scenario or model? Or project.
Yeah, so this, I might have to lean a little bit on Aubrey, but I know it's a adjusted production costs across each of the futures. So in the past, we've had four, and there's been a equal weighting. So essentially, there's been a 25% mix with the three futures. We still have the equal weighting. So essentially, it'd be a 33 1/3 percent. And so we're looking at a cumulative adjusted production cost savings of 1.25. And I believe Don't we have to have a 1.0 in each future, or is that kind of what we're targeting for?
So just to back up, Commissioner, again, what we would say, if you get to that point, so the futures actually inform some of the analysis, as Tony's talked about, when you think about market efficiency projects or any kind of economic project that we may undertake. And where that actually gets to, we hear us speak of a no regrets project. What that assumes is that if there's a project that's put forward to solve a congestion type issue, when that project is analyzed against each one of the futures, then it would have to show a benefit in excess of 1.25. And so each one of those futures would have to have that. So if it did not benefit the cost ratio above 1.25 in each future, then the project would not necessarily move forward if it was an economic project.
Okay.
Thank you, Aubrey. One note that I would like to make on this slide and basically the next two slides after this is that these results are preliminary. So this is what we've shown at the August Planning Advisory Committee. At the August Planning Advisory Committee, we did ask for stakeholder feedback on the resource expansion and the siting. And so we've received a lot of that feedback. Kind of foreshadowing some of the materials that we have posted for tomorrow's Planning Advisory Committee, but we have made some changes or some modification updates to some of the future cost assumptions for each of the fuel types. And we're looking into some siting changes as well. So we're actively, you know, making those updates right now and are going to be rerunning the resource expansion analysis. So I think these results are, you know, showing the path. I don't think the trajectory is going to be changing, but the specific values could change. So I just wanted to make sure I caveated that. We can go to the next slide. And actually, I think I'll skip this one because it's essentially the same as the previous slide.
Okay.
So this slide number 15 we have up on the screen is showing the same set of results, but from a capacity perspective. So the pie charts on the previous slide that we were discussing was from an energy perspective. This is looking at it from a capacities perspective. And each one of these bar charts are cumulative. So it's, as you're going through time, it's keeping a running tally of the resources that we're adding. This particular chart is showing each of the three futures by a kind of given milestone year that aligns with a particular model that we're building, and it's broken out by fuel type. So anything that's positive is reflecting a addition, and anything that's negative is reflecting what kind of retirements we have projected in that particular future. It sounded like there might have been someone trying to get in with a question.
I don't think so.
Okay, sorry.
Mm-hmm. It's all right.
But as you could probably expect with the carbon emission goals that the two of the three futures have, you're seeing a lot of solar hybrid, which in this case is a solar plus battery storage, as well as wind and natural gas being built.
So I'm going to ask you a question, and for the example, I'm going to use...
Randy, you got to turn your mic on.
Oops, sorry about that. So question, and for the example, I'm going to use 2040, because I see an example of my point there. There's wind being taken offline and wind being added online. So if I could easily see that being a wind farm being decommissioned and removed from the prairie and another new one being added somewhere else. But if a wind farm in that time frame is repurposed again, does that show up as the reduction and the addition, or would that just not show up on here at all?
Yeah, that's a great question, and is a something that's different from the previous NTEP cycles. So new to this suite of MISO futures, we had a retirement assumption around wind. So in previous MTEC cycles, we were hearing folks that were, especially with the tax credits, they were repowering older wind farms. So some wind farms may have had useful life in their, as far as the aging of their particular turbines, but because of the advances in technology and the tax credits, folks were basically kind of ripping out some of the older wind turbines and replacing them with newer, more efficient turbines, not only to increase their basically capacity that they can deliver, but also taking advantage of those tax credits. And so the wind retirements that you're seeing here are driven by the retirement assumptions that we're making. So as you see retirements here, they're essentially being added back to the top as you retire.
Thank you.
Good catch. And we do assume a 25-year retirement assumption.
Is there any correlation between this, what you're showing here, and your efforts on resource adequacy? And maybe Aubrey can explain how or if these slides and your kind of vision that you're outlining here relates to or informs your resource adequacy work.
So thank you, Commissioner. I think the short answer is yes, there is a connection. I think as we think about a couple of different things, long term, what this slide sort of tells us is what that resource mix looks like going forward, where we may see things develop. I think short term, what we also have to think about is what are our stakeholders' near-term plans and how they plan to address things, whether it be with low modifying resources, whether it be with quicker projects that get through either a small distribution type resource or something that's already in the queue for them coming on board, or that they forestall some of the retirement. So I think it's a contributing factor, but it's more of a contributing factor and informant to some of the resource adequacy work.
Okay, thank you, Aubrey.
All right. My next slide, which I think is also my last slide, is depicting the preliminary siting for that resource expansion plan specific to North Dakota. And so we have the visualization of each of the three futures. It kind of becomes an eye chart in a way with the various different shapes and colors and sizes of the bubbles and shapes. But one of the things I wanted to highlight is, you know, we just got done talking about the wind repowerment assumptions. So depicted in these sighting images, the triangles are showing that repowerment. So you know, as you can see, you know, our future projections, at least for North Dakota, is showing a lot of wind repowerment. It's also showing several gas units being built, whether it's a combined cycle combustion turbine or the combined cycle capture installation. You can see that as the gray dots in Future 3. But generally, you know, this is, you know, at least our preliminary initial sighting for the state of North Dakota.
How does the model decide where to place the dots, like especially on Future 3?
Yeah, so our model actually doesn't perform any of the sighting. So the tool that we use is basically spits out what the most economic generation expansion options would be. And then we have to go and manually sight those. You know, depending on the technology type, we have differing siting criteria that we follow. For the renewables, it's a hybrid process that is blending some technical potential analysis that we get from a consultant, Vibrant Clean Energy, with you know, overlaying that with some of the queue activity that MISO is seeing, and that's how we're getting the wind and solar siting methodology. You know, the gas, the thermal units are a little more straightforward in looking at, you know, proximity to, you know, how are the fuels being delivered. So in the case of natural gas, you know, it's proximity to pipelines, mm-hmm. you know, making sure we're not placing them in any kind of environmental or, you know, other sensitive areas. Does that help
yep,
address your question?
It does. I'm curious if transmission plays into effect at all, but.
It is. And so we do look at brownfield sites as well. So as things are retiring, we look at that as a prime candidate for putting new generation in, especially for the thermals. And so that is part of that as well. New to this set of future development is we are performing a N-1 power flow analysis, just making sure that we're, by placing a dot on the map, that we're not immediately overloading the system. And so we're trying to kind of capture some of that in there as well.
Okay. And the wind stuff, the renewable stuff that I see in Future 3, that transmission.
Yeah. So
I mean, there's, yeah, transmission.
We are leveraging the old regional generator outlet study zones, the RGOS zones. The MVP analysis. And then from there, we're using various tiers that are looking at, you know, renewable potential and kind of generator queue activity. With the renewable siting, we also kind of employ kind of a collector system mentality, where we're trying to cluster renewables in kind of a 20-mile zone, and then we'll have a collector kind of transmission, you know, connecting that and distributing that out to kind of get away from, you know, overloading the kind of the local area of which, you know, those type of upgrades would be identified in Andy's process as those wind farms are trying to interconnect.
Okay, thank you. It doesn't look like we have any more questions on our end on your stuff, Tony.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay. Well, good morning, Commissioners. Again, this is Aubrey Johnson. I'm
happy for the opportunity to speak with you this morning about our long-range transmission planning effort. looking forward to the opportunity to be back in North Dakota to do this in person. So hopefully next year, this time, we'll be in a position to do that. If you've been to any of these system planning committee meetings in both June or the formal board meeting just a couple weeks ago in September, you've seen long-range transmission planning as a major topic of that. The reason why is things are changing. I think Tony's presentation and Andy's presentation both give real insight as to how resource mix is changing, and our stakeholders are telling us that as well, too. And so what we've started to think about over the last year or so as we've worked with the Midwest Governors Association, as we've gone around and visited different states, as we kicked off this long-range transmission planning effort, we certainly think that now is the time to really focus on trying to address the resource portfolio shift that we see occurring within the MISO footprint. In the last year plus, we've received several letters suggesting and recommending that we move and act on this now, most notably from the Midwest Governors Association. We've seen that received a request from the CapEx 2020 group, from a group of Midwest transmission owners, from a couple other environmental type groups as well too, all basically saying that the time is now. And if you think about what's in our future one, which is most of the announced plans for many states and member utilities, this is all about what their resource mix should look like in, say, 2030, which is about 10 years out. And if you think about it takes anywhere from 8 to 15 years to build transmission, the evidence suggests that we should be here now and that we might actually be a little bit behind. If we take a look at the slide that's in front of you now, it talks about and shares with you the type of planning horizons that we typically see. When we think about our MPET cycles, which is where we currently are now, I believe both Tony and Andy mentioned that the 18-month MISO transmission expansion planning cycle, typically what we see is interconnection planning, which is the work that Andy and his team are doing. Reliability planning, which is your basic making sure that we have all of our NERC responsibility met, that all of the systems are in place to keep the lights on. The market efficiency planning, which is a function of some of the work that Tony and his teams do with the futures and other members of our team also do. Those are things that happen that are part of our normal MPEP cycle. We've done long-range transmission planning in the past. Tony mentioned the Regional Generation Overlay Study, RGOS, which was a feeder to the multi-value project. That's all been done in the past, but we haven't done that type of work since going back to 2007, 2011. And so what we look at and think about the work that we see on the horizon, when we think about the resource portfolio shift we see on the horizon, we think that the time is now to really move forward and take a hard look at what the system is going to look like and what that portfolio needs to be to meet that. We can move to the next slide, please. So I mentioned that 2011 was the last cycle where we fully saw that. As you can see from this bar graph, that in 2011, you saw 17 multi-value projects valued at about $6 billion that were part of that MPET cycle that were approved and moved through at that time. Since that time, it has really been more so local reliability, some interconnection project type activity, and a couple market efficiency projects and targeted market efficiency projects. So the vast majority of the work, got a little backbeat there, the vast majority of the work really has been around a local reliability project. As we see in MTEP 20, we announced last week the preliminary results. We're going to see a doubling of generator interconnection projects, roughly about $540 million or so of generator interconnection projects are in the queue for approval as part of this MTEP cycle. but nothing really on a full-scale regional look like we had with the multi-value project. And so as we think about that, one of the things we continue to say is we don't see this long-range transmission planning effort approaching and looking like what we've done in the past relative to 2011 and the MVPs. One is it took us roughly between 4 to 7 years, depending upon how you think about it, to get those suite of projects together and bring forward to the board for approval. Again, if I go back and say that it takes anywhere from 8 to 15 years to build transmission, and you think about the announced plans and the things that are listed in Future One, working 5 to 7 years to try to come up with a suite of projects to package up as a multi-value project would not allow us to meet the needs of many of the stakeholders in the states within the region that suggests where we want to be. The other thing that's a big driver is MISO has grown since 2011 with the addition of the southern portion of the footprint. And also, I believe that generally speaking, most stakeholders have got to the point where there's not a support for the cost allocation that goes along with the multi-value project portfolio. And so those are the reasons why we don't see that as being the path forward for this type of long-range transmission planning effort. And we see that this view, we think about it happening over the next 2 to 4 type MTEP cycles, where we will take a deeper look and look at things both on a regional level and a sub-regional level to achieve an overall similar outcome. We can move to the next slide, please.
Just a quick question, Aubrey. On the $540 million, is it million? Yeah, of generation interconnect projects in the next MTEP, how are those GI projects cost allocated?
If you will, I have a slide on that? But the bottom line is the generator interconnection project, when they are, there's a little bit, I'll pick that up in cost allocation, but to get specifically to your question, the generators or the developers pay for any upgrades that are necessary for them, for their resource to interconnect to the grid, unless if the project is on 345 kV or higher.
Okay.
If 345 kV or higher, then 10% of that project is postage stamp to load.
Okay, thank you.
And that we do have a slide in the cost allocation that will refer to that as well, too.
Perfect.
What we show here, just we'll hit these next two slides really pretty quickly. One of the things we recognize also when we think about long-range transmission planning is there's no one-size-fits-all. When we think about our stakeholders and our member transmission owners, this is a great representation of four different transmission owners across our different footprint and what their fleets look like today and what we project their fleets look like in 10 plus years. And so each of those cases present a different unique challenge for us when you think about system planning and how the system will be set up to support that. And so what that means is that we need to look both regionally and sub-regionally as where these member companies are located and ensuring that all of the needs of the region are met, and recognizing also that not everyone is traveling at the same pace and space and time. And so we have to think about how we try to accommodate that when we're trying to build and put together these plans. Next slide, please. And so finally, so also with some of the real work that we've already started doing, what it also does is it gives us an indication of how things are set up and where some of the costs and some of the challenges might be relative to trying to meet some of the needs with Future One. What you see, the dashed lines are where you may have some things that may be necessary for voltage support and other ways that we may have to address that. These are all meant to be indicative type maps and indicative type information to help inform the work that is taking place in the long range transmission plan that we're trying to undertake as we speak now. But it just goes to show a little bit of the type of analysis that's already underway and where we see the greatest needs for transmission based upon where we think things are today and where that siting would occur.
So, Aubrey, here's a question on this slide. Obviously, this is concerning to us because a lot of the hotspots are in or near our state. And I look at the first bullet. Issues are driven by reduction in conventional generation, the increase in inverter-based generation. So this gets to, I think, where we're going down in resource adequacy. But at what point does MISO put more emphasis on a market that incentivizes and encourages generation of the kind that maintains and reliability without additional transmission investments? I mean, it looks to me like there's two choices. You can invest more in transmission, or you can incentivize and provide the proper market incentives to encourage conventional generation and less inverter-based generation. I mean, how do you guys decide what you're going to emphasize?
So I would say that's a great question, and I think it's an answer of both. And I think one of the challenges that we have, and that I see a little bit, is which comes first, right? Is the market product out there first that says, hey, you know, this product is here, and so if you have this generation resource, there's a value for you to be in the market, and we're going to incentivize you, we're going to compensate you, or does the market react because you have to start building all of this stuff? Which one happens first? And I don't have a good answer for you today, but I do know that is something that we're having discussions about internally as we speak about with our strategic teams, and we think about some of these longer, broader initiatives as part of our overall reliability imperative. So that is a very good question that is central to some of these larger discussions about how we move forward. And if I could move to the next slide, I think it also tees up a little bit about how you actually build out the system. It's a very related conversation here.
One other quick follow-up on that, though. Is it possible for MISO in your analysis to provide some numbers in terms of the economics on the two choices? Like, if we go more this direction, this is the impact on costs. If we go more in this direction, the other direction, this is what we're looking at in terms of costs. Because I think, you know, without that those cost figures, it's really hard for people to make, for stakeholders to make proper decisions on what's the best course or how to balance that mix and, you know, and under what time frame we need to get to the end goal that people are seeking in terms of resource mix and renewables, et cetera. So how can MISO provide those figures to help inform that planning and those decisions?
So I have to take it back to the broader team from a market perspective and ask about the market products and how market products and market pricing can inform some of that. I'm not prepared to take that on today, so
right.
We'll take that back and answer that as a larger question.
Okay. It is a big question. I just feel like you guys are in the position to provide that information, and I understand it's also information that is going to be controversial, and people may not want to, you know, like what you say. But it also is not appropriate to go one direction and then look back and say, oh, and here's what it's going to cost, by the way, and it's too late because you've retired all these other resources, and that would have been we could have kept them open and alive for 5 or 10 more years and saved ratepayers billions of dollars. So I really, really think that that's an important question, one that I'll keep asking.
You know, I think that's a question that has come up a lot on the North Dakota side. There was actually a good article written on this, I'm going to say 3-4 months ago. And that is, you know, what is the cost of the additional transmission going to be? And you know, the same points that Commissioner Fedorchuk made and you know, a few others, I suppose. But are there any lessons that can be learned? I keep going back to the MVP projects. And the MVP projects were to alleviate congestion, but then I did read something. I think it was, and I don't have it with, but one of the primary drivers for the MVP projects was to add new intermittent resources to the grid, which seemed counterintuitive that in some ways you're alleviating congestion while filling the lines, you know, shortly after they've been constructed. Big Stone, South Ellendale being an example with resource additions on our end. It seems like the transmission is following renewable energy objectives. As more intermittent comes on, it's creating additional transmission problems, and then the solution is to put more transmission in place and allow for more resource additions. And I think it seems like the bulk of the markets are comfortable with that, though.
That question?
Yeah, that's it's a very broad question. So,
I'm not a market person, so I'm sorry, I don't have a lot to add to that discussion. I will say I echo your thoughts. I do think that those are valid points to come back to that discussion. I think, as I think about the slide that we have up, it does begin to speak to some of the things that we think add to this conversation to a certain extent, because one of the things that we are trying to make part of the conversation, there's not a lot of numbers on this chart, but what we are sharing with all stakeholders is we believe that the portfolio shift has moved towards a 40% renewable energy penetration level across the MISO footprint is $150 billion plus effort, if you will. And if we think about that, depending upon how we pursue that, anywhere from 10 to 30 billion of that is transmission related. The vast majority of that is the new resources, the new energy resources, the new renewable resources that are necessary to achieve that portfolio shift. And so as Commissioner Fedorchuk is kind of asked or is somewhat implied in there, and what we're trying to say is how you plan out this system, it matters as to where you get that. This is what we called a little bit of a smile curve. On the far left, we talk about how if you do a widely distributed generation, if you spread the generation all across the system, you can have a lower transmission investment, but it'll have a higher generation investment because you're creating more generating resources closer to load, so therefore you need less transmission. If you go to the far right, you would optimize generation resources, but you'd end up with higher transmission costs because you have to carry that energy where the load is. If you look at where we have the circle, this is where currently you have a little bit more of the member plans, if you will, because there's not a lot of optimization, if you will. It's more of, you know, states thinking about how they may solve their own issues. And so if you start thinking about where we might see at the very bottom of this curve, where it's an optimal generation and transmission build out, that is trying to think about, is there a way we can effectively look at for lack of a better term, how do you minimize both your generation and your transmission investment, which would also, I imply, trying to think about, you know, also what are the other marketing impacts that might come into that. So, you know, as we are trying to undertake this and thinking about our futures process and thinking about that concept of no regrets, then there has to be a case of how do we make the most use of our existing right-of-ways? How do we make the most use of resources that do have benefits? And there are some of those questions that are unanswered that are part of that, but it is not lost on MISO that there are opportunities, if you will, to think about how you optimize this process to get to a point where we are minimizing the total cost of investment to customers across the field.
Aubrey, this is a fascinating chart. I'm going to have to think about this some. So someday I may have follow-up questions. But you made a statement, if I understood it right, it's an important perspective. So I just want to make sure that I'm accurate on this. Did you say a move to 40% renewables across the MISO footprint requires $150 billion of investment?
Roughly, that's what some of our estimates come up with.
Not just transmission, generation and transmission. What portion of that was transmission, Aubrey?
Yes, that's the total cost to achieve. Our estimates are between 10 to 30 billion would be transmission, and the balance of that would be your generation resources.
Okay. And then, I don't know.
So as our president says, this is not a trivial process.
Yeah.
Certainly not. At some point, I want to go back a slide. I have a question on your previous slide, too.
Okay.
I do want to do a quick time check. We have this scheduled until, is it 11?
Yeah.
Are you guys, we have two more pretty substantial components of it. Do we want to just go longer? I don't know if MISO is available longer, or
I can't go much longer than 11.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll just have to
wait for another commitment at 11. So.
Okay. Well, we'll have to. We can always
question.
Carry. Well, you don't. I didn't mean that, but I just want to make sure that we're not cutting short some of the other stuff that you guys may have requested on the agenda.
Well, let me just do this. If I could go to my last slide, which is our schedule. And just talk a little bit about this, and I can voice over a couple of things. So one, this is a schedule we want to work off of. I skipped a couple of slides, and I'll hit that in the sense of saying that a couple of things. To get to any of this, we recognize that one is we have to keep working and talking with stakeholders, and when we talk about building consensus, we know that not everybody's going to agree. And so that's not what we are trying to achieve, but we want to make sure that we keep everyone informed. We're working on trying to figure out the best overall solutions. I think what's been echoed here and some of the conversations, we have to build good, strong, robust business case. I think that's your charge, is to ensure that for the citizens of your state. So all of the projects that may come out of this effort have to pass that muster and be proven to be prudent and useful. And then finally, you have to have cost allocation and recovery mechanisms, making sure that food benefits also pay for that. So those are things that are there. This is a high-level schedule of things that we're working on to try to move this initiative forward. And one of the things we've continued to say is that our preliminary analysis says that if everything continues to, the trains continue to run on schedule, that it's a possibility we could have some initial projects be included in MTEP 21. This is a pretty heavy topic. It is a topic that will be present in virtually all of our board meetings going forward, and I'm certain that if this body wants to hear more details, that our external affairs team will facilitate future meetings for us to come sit down and have a more detailed discussion.
Good. You good, Randy? Okay. Thank you, Aubrey. It is possible, too, if we run out of time, because the next one I think is going to be quite of interest. We could have a separate maybe meeting just to discuss cost allocation in the not-too-distant future. So if we don't have time for that piece, more on that piece, we could save that. So now we're on the forward market needs. I forgot who was going to do this one.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Kevin Vinoy. I'm the director of market design at MISO, and I'm here to talk about our forward market needs and our integrated roadmap and the work that we're doing around our forward market needs. So a number of years ago, MISO undertook what we're calling our resource availability and need initiative, and we've identified a number of key drivers that are impacting the industry from the aging and retirement of our generation portfolio, reliance on intermittent resources and interchange or unscheduled resources, and just the different variable energy uncertainty that shows up in our markets on a day-to-day basis. And so as a result, we're investigating what types of tools or improvements or things that does MISO need to consider to get the right resources available for our day-ahead and real-time energy markets. We're seeing a need for availability, flexibility, and visibility with growing uncertainty behind the meter or demand response resources, and just the risk that can be introduced with some of these longer lead historical baseload units. We're seeing that almost on the whole that these longer lead baseload resources are no longer self-committing themselves or must-running themselves, especially when they're coming off of outages. And because there's a lot of financial risk that the prices that they may be getting in the markets may not be covering all their costs on a shorter, long-run basis. And so they may wait for the markets to turn them on. And some of these resources can be out of reach of the day-ahead market because it's really just a 24 to 36 hour optimization process. And so with this effort, we're investigating how do we get the right resources available to the day ahead market, and what can we do to improve decision making that our market participants are doing with respect to their resources when it comes to outages, operations, and availability to the market. And so that's why we're looking at our forward markets.
Say, Kevin, really quickly, when you say the right resources available, can you define what right is?
So right resources, the markets, obviously we need contingency reserves to meet our NERC standards, but we're finding more and more with uncertainty, we may need shorter lead resources like our gas-fired resources for real-time flexibility. And if we've historically had those gas units in reserve to meet variations and uncertainty with real-time generation availability and load forecast uncertainty. And so one of the ways that I like to think about it is if we pass on some of these longer lead baseload resources and we rely entirely on our short lead resources, we're having fewer and fewer reserves that we can call on to meet those real-time uncertainties when they materialize. And so it's we're looking to find a way to balance the use of and the commitment of all the resources in the market. So make sure that we have enough short lead resources to manage the uncertainty that shows up in real time, and that we have enough baseload resources to cover that, and that we're not getting ourselves into shortage conditions because we otherwise passed on longer lead or intermediate resources that could have been available in real time.
Thank you.
So this is our RAN initiatives that we've been highlighting for next year, really coming out of our 2020 MISO Forward report. You know, in the operating horizon, we're talking that, 7 days to really the next minute or hour of operations. Are we providing the right, do we have the right tools to manage the uncertainty? Do we have the right products in place to go out and procure those necessary reserves that we might need in that time frame? And are the prices reflecting the system needs? And when we do get scarce, are those signals showing up to get us the supply and demand response that we need? Next slide, please. And so a lot of the drivers, and this probably comes right out of our previous MISO Forward reports, but you know, we identified the need for more availability, flexibility, and visibility, and the industry drivers are really driving up these needs. So we're seeing a lot of baseload and long lead resources. They're aging, they're retiring, they're trying to better manage their operations and align with the periods where they're economic to run, whether there are not cheaper options available through, say, market purchases or other bilateral options. Reserve margins are shrinking as we see with these retirements, we're closing in on our minimum planning reserve margins. Fuel prices have had a major effect because we see gas competing on par with coal units in our day-ahead markets, and so that's causing pressure on some of these larger, more capital-intensive fixed-cost units. We see an increase in emergency-only capacity. Through our capacity market, our utilities are bringing resources that are only available during emergencies because they're associated with either retail programs or other contractual arrangements that are only available if we declare a system-wide emergency or a regional emergency. As we saw with FERC distributed energy resources, we have limited visibility to those things on the distribution system, as well as there's a lot of uncertainty. The more the load starts behaving less traditional than it has, because of things like behind the meter solar and distributed resources, the variability and uncertainty with even the grid connected renewables, interchange from our neighbors, which may or may not be available depending on system conditions and pricing, and then having to forecast what resources are going to be available across the portfolio, and also talked about the variability of renewables driving higher needs for flexibility. And so next slide, please. So really, we're having to plan for a lot of things that we historically haven't had to consider. We could just plug our medium-term forecast and participants could plug their expectations of market pricing and market needs out for days and weeks into the future and have a pretty be pretty confident that their decisions were were going to be accurate, but with more and more uncertainty around pricing, market results, and availability of supply, and the expectations of demand, we're finding that these decisions are harder and harder to make. We've been out interviewing and talking with a lot of the market participants who operate these long lead baseload units, and asking them what considerations did they utilize when they're making these availability decisions, whether it's to go on outage for a shorter maintenance period, bring a unit back from outage, or even plan an extended outage if they feel the market conditions are not supporting their operations. And so there are fuel procurement decisions that also go into the mix, and the expectation of revenues that they can generate in the market, or pursue other you know, supply arrangements if they feel like those are more beneficial to serve their loads. And so we framed up this question with our stakeholders. We're if you go to the next slide, we're kind of in the frame and evaluate or portion of our integrated roadmap process. So we've got a fairly well-developed problem statement, and now we're looking to evaluate what are some options that we can investigate. Last year, we implemented what we call the multi-day operating margin forecast, which provides the marketplace with what MISO's view of capacity and demand and interchange type factors might be available over the next 7 days, or the operating day plus the next 6 days. So what are we looking at to make our decisions on a forward basis, and providing that same information out to the market space to help them better decide on resource availability and make their operational decisions. We're looking at our forward commitment tools that extend beyond the day-ahead market. Are there improvements to forecasting, to resource availability, to outage coordination, to things that we can use and improve on those tools? And we've even been evaluating the idea of a multi-day market. So are there other market solutions to this that might be financially binding or provide forward price signals beyond the day-ahead market? And so the next slide is really just gives an overview of the key industry drivers for the resource availability and need, and what's driving the needs for our flexibility, visibility, and availability. So just the things that we observed several years ago, as we see a lot of requirements, availability, outage correlation. So what that means is we're seeing emergency conditions not only in the summer time, but when we have high level of generation outages, driving and unexpected either hot weather conditions or cold weather conditions given the season. And so I think I hit on a bunch of these earlier, but these are just the kind of the macro drivers that are really making those forward decisions harder to make. So, and then my last slide really are the considerations that we're looking at when it comes to, you know, what do we need to be talking to stakeholders about and evaluating. You know, we're definitely seeing long lead resources almost move away from self-scheduling their operations and waiting for market conditions to signal their return to service after, say, an outage, or even planning longer downtimes.
Yeah, Kevin,
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I got hung up on, I think it was the slide before. Is there any way on the key industry drivers? They're not, so you have the five bullet points on the left. Are they, I'm assuming they're not equally weighted, or are they from a methodology standpoint?
They really came out of some analysis that we did a couple of years ago, and so I think it all depends. I think as they'll continue to evolve. So for instance, with outage correlation, we've made some changes to our accreditation of capacity and some of our outage coordination tools to try to mitigate that the demand side. We're working to see if we can get more of that demand side into the market, or at least get better visibility and understanding of their availability in real time. And then as we're looking at intermittent and unscheduled resources, we're working on things like price formation and reserve products. Are there new tools that we need to address those? And so obviously intermittent is probably going to overtake the aging retirement of units because of just the amount of intermittent resources we're adding. I think this 2020 will be a record year, even after 2019, of the amount of intermittent resources we're adding to the system. And so I think you're right, these are, they're not necessarily equal, but they're all challenging.
Okay, I think actually you, the last statement you made, not the "you're right" statement, the one before that answered my question. That helps. Thank you,
Kevin. I have two questions. One is kind of philosophical, so I'll start with this one, and maybe after you finish talking about the slide, ask the other one. The big change that's occurred in all of the transformation of the resource mix is uncertainty has been introduced in a level that is much more significant than it used to be. You even indicated that in some of your earlier slides. I know how the transmission owners get how uncertainty is reflected in their planning with their reserve margins, et cetera. But how does the market reflect the cost of uncertainty, and who is paying for it? Today's market design. The cost of this uncertainty and who pays?
Yeah, that's a great question. So right now in the market, we keep contingency reserves, and that's really to deal with really the uncertainty of our largest generation resources being available or tripping off and having to maintain balance and restore the system. And so that's one form of uncertainty, and that's addressed by contingency reserves. And the moment-to-moment balancing of the system is regulating reserves. And so in all told, we pay for those two uncertainties, the moment-to-moment balance of energy with regulating reserves, which we buy about $40 million a year of regulating reserves, and then we buy about $60 to $80 million a year in contingency reserves, which is fairly cheap, when you think about the size of the system, the amount of load served. So that ends up being, pennies per megawatt hour. But as we move into the future, right now, the rest of this uncertainty is managed outside of the market prices through the commitment of resources in our resource assessment commitment, our reliability assessment commitment that our operators are making, in the day the day ahead and even up to the week ahead. We're trying to manage those uncertainties, and so those costs are managed by those commitments, which may or may not materialize in market prices. And so if we're carrying extra online capacity to manage uncertainties and we don't use that higher cost capacity to actually serve energy, we essentially make the resources whole to their costs. And so those are kind of a pay as bid product that we uplift or spread to the marketplace to cover those costs. So that uncertainty is reflected in kind of what we call the revenue sufficiency guarantee payments that we make to those resources that we call on to manage that uncertainty. We take it very seriously. We try to minimize the amount of uncertainty that we address through real-time commitments, but realize that we do have to make those from time to time. So that's reflected in our operational metrics, but in short, those costs come through through some of the market uplift charges.
So in all the costs, in all of the instances you outlined, the cost of the uncertainty is borne by the market as a whole. It's uplifted to everybody.
Even our contingency and regulating reserves are allocated to the kind of the load serving entities across the footprint.
Okay. I'm not sure if you got through your last slide.
Oh yeah, go to the next slide, please. Back one. So these are the things that we're looking at as the fleet. Next slide, please. I think it's 33. As the fleet ages and retires, and we add more non-conventional intermittent units, we're having to understand what's driving the availability and the commitment of long lead units, our need to commit those. When we see those uncertainties in the next day or the next week time horizon, how do we make sure that we utilize the resources that we have to their best extent and have them available for the day ahead market when they're going to be needed, and also help our market participants make those decisions to effectively and efficiently serve their customers. So, and as I said in the answer to the last question, do we have the right market reserve products? Because the benefit of having a reserve product versus kind of paying uplift is by pricing those reserves, you're putting a value on it and a potential revenue stream to drive investments in things that can give you the capabilities that you need, or reserve those capabilities like I talked about before. If we have if we can add a reserve product that values the flexibility and that the quick, short lead availability of resources. Not only is that going to provide revenue and incentives for those resources, but it also can kind of help to better schedule those long lead resources, because when we start getting short on those reserves that we need for uncertainty, we'll start raising overall market prices and better compensates with those basically units which are trying to determine whether or not they should be running.
Kevin, have you or any of the other RTOs that you watch, have you ever looked at doing the flip of what you've just suggested, which is incentivizing the long lead time folks? And that would be, the opposite would be to charge those resources that are uncertain for being uncertain?
I'm not aware of any anything like that. I know that there are performance penalties, and I think in other markets, especially the kind of the eastern capacity markets in New England and PJM, if these capacity resources are not available to meet the highest system demands, they can receive significant penalties for not being available or online. I think there's a balance there between having the right units on when needed, and kind of penalizing folks for not being there, because you want to optimize what's available. And I think that recognizing that our day ahead market is only a short window, and it can't take into consideration all of the costs and considerations that these long lead resources have to evaluate when they're deciding to run for a long period.
Okay. Do you guys have any more questions for Kim?
No, not at this time, given the time constraints. So. But thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks.
All right. Do you guys want to spend 5 minutes on intro on cost allocation? I think Aubrey can probably cover it fairly quickly and then tee it up for a longer discussion next time, maybe.
Yeah.
No, that's fine. In fact, as I step out, I'm just going to pick it up off the live stream off my phone, and I'll be muted, but I can listen.
Okay.
So,
Aubrey, you're up.
Yes, ma'am. So, Aubrey Johnson again. So, really, in this place, what we've done here is giving you really the detail specific where you can go and look at the tariff and get really the specific levels of what's been changed and where you can find those cost allocation changes. So this information is here for the record and for any staff that really wants to have the official words on what cost allocation changes were made. On the next slide, please. The primary change that took place was prior to this FERC, to this update, we did not have a mechanism to address market efficiency projects below 345 kV. And so the FERC approval that occurred back, I believe it was on July 28th, actually lowered the voltage level for market efficiency projects to 230 kV, and it removed the 20% postage stamp allocation. So those were the two main points that were taking place, and it also added these additional benefit metrics, which are avoided reliability projects and the MISO SPP settlement agreement costs. And so that was the major change that we were seeing, and also provided some protection for baseline reliability projects that also meet the definition of a market efficiency project. Those would still be considered baseline reliability projects as long as they were needed within 36 months or 3 years of board approval. So those would not be cost shared. Those would still be borne by the transmission owner and charged to the local zone. That is the big change. Those are the big changes that actually take place. There are some other changes that basically on the PJM scene would and relate to compliance filing that we received with NIPSCO. Lowers that voltage down to 100 kV, but that does not affect North Dakota, which is on the SPP. So these are the major changes that we've seen with the cost allocation methodology, and it relates to market efficiency projects and how they're treated in their voltage level.
All right. how do you guys intend to deal with the cost allocation on your long-term transmission planning?
So, Commissioner Fedorchuk, that's a couple of different things. So the OMS, I understand, has put together a group that's working on developing some cost allocation principles. So I think that work is beginning to step forward. Initially, I believe we look at this to say we will work with the existing suite of project definitions, project allocations, which are essentially your cost allocation. What we do think is that there are a couple of things that are out there on the horizon that could possibly be in play, and you know, we'll see how stakeholders look at that. And they may be taking a look at multi-value projects and how that is set up, and whether or not we work to change how that cost allocation methodology is in play. We've also heard from several transmission owners about thinking about how a generator or generator developers might bear some additional costs associated with transmission projects to ensure that they are viable and picking up some of the costs that the project or the developer would bear some additional costs. We don't know how you do those things just yet, but we think that part of any substantive cost allocation discussions should begin to take place after we've been able to do some initial screening and have a better insight to what some of those projects might actually look like and would be able to better inform the discussion around cost allocation.
All right. Any questions, Randy?
Not at this time.
Okay. All right. Well, it's 11 o'clock. It looks like we did it. Got through everything. Victor, did you have any? You've been really chatty this morning.
I know. I couldn't help myself. No, I don't have any questions. Appreciate the material from myself. Good presentation.
Awesome. All righty. And I haven't heard Adam. He's on the phone, I think. He must not have any questions either. So. Okay. I think he said something, but I couldn't hear it. So,
I have one thing just generally.
Okay.
So I just want to bring up something that happened a few weeks or a month ago while you're on the line, because I found it extraordinarily frustrating. I asked for some information, or Adam asked for the information, and I was doing a public presentation, and this had nothing to do with individual companies. There should have been no trade secret issues involved with it. And I've seen the email string. I know, Allison, you were trying to be helpful, so I do appreciate that. And I appreciate that I ultimately got it, but it took weeks. By then, my presentation was over. We made the same request of SPP, and we got it that day. I think it was probably within the hour. And, you know, it makes, Commissioner Fedorchuk mentioned at the beginning that you're a very important partner in making sure this system works. Well, by being so slow to respond, and since it ultimately was available and SPP could provide it so quickly, it tells me that none of your data people just even took it seriously at all and tried. And it made me look bad. And when my response to the public is that here's the information from one RTO, the other one, that's just behind the curtain stuff, I can't get it, it makes you look bad. And it doesn't give people faith in their electric system and our American system as a whole. And so I know we don't regulate you, but I just want to emphasize, I think it is important that while we recognize your importance, I think you all need to recognize the importance of state utility regulators and work to somehow find a way to be able to respond more quickly to data requests.
Okay. Thank you, Randy. And with that, we'll reschedule this again in another 3 months, I think, and look forward to ongoing conversations in between. Thanks so much, everybody. We'll be back on at 2 with SPP, correct? 2 o'clock. All righty. Thank you.